UTC.
Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Wednesday, April 5th, 2023. South Sudan's Auditor General says the country's central bank is doing very little to address the fluctuating dollar rate in Juba.
Bank of South Sudan has not been able to supervise the commercial banks in terms of where the foreign exchange that is given to the commercial banks is utilized.
And a former chairperson of the Finance and Economic Committee in South Sudan's National Legislative Assembly says the country's economy is under siege.
And the cartels are much stronger than the parliament. You know that? They have resources and they can divert the resources necessary anytime, you know? So it's not that parliament is weak.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some South Sudanese traders and economists are calling on the government of South Sudan to set up a regulatory body that can help control the fluctuating exchange rate of South Sudanese pounds to the U.S. dollar. South Sudan's Auditor General, Stephen Wundu, blames the Central Bank of South Sudan for what he calls inadequate supervision of foreign exchange rates in the market. For VOA News, Juliana Shiapai reports from Juba.
South Sudan's Auditor General, Stephen Wundu, says the unpredictable exchange rates of the U.S. dollars to South Sudanese pound dates back to an audit report he submitted to the Central Bank of South Sudan in 2013. He says the report had good recommendations. Wundu says the Bank of South Sudan is not keen on supervising foreign exchange rate at commercial banks.
We have consistently found out that the Bank of South Sudan supervisory activity is not adequate. The Bank of South Sudan has not been able to supervise the commercial banks in terms of where the foreign exchange that is given to the commercial banks is utilized. Neither is the Bank of South Sudan really having adequate control of its own currency unit. We have cases about mismanagement of currency in the central bank. So the foreign currency that is auctioned and given to the Forex Bureau and the commercial banks does not translate into imported goods at that exchange rate.
Wundu added that once a foreign currency finds itself in the black market, prices of basic commodities could shoot up due to the cost incurred during imports. Yosa Otuha is a trader at Libya Market in Juba. He says the government of South Sudan is doing very little to control the exchange rate of South Sudanese pound to the U.S. dollars.
The government should set a regulatory body that can help in controlling the dollar prices. Maybe we could be talking of a Bureau of Standard, so that they are going to control, or they will impose things, laws that will govern the day-to-day running of the dollars, because at the moment everything depends on the black market.
Otuha stressed that the government of South Sudan should give foreign currency to forex bureaus at a set exchange rate. He says the uncontrolled skyrocketing dollar exchange rate in South Sudan is not good news to traders who import goods from Kenya, Sudan, and Uganda. The official South Sudan government rate stands at $1 exchanging for 840 South Sudanese pound. The parallel market sells $1 for 860 South Sudanese pounds. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shiapai in Juba.
Still on economic issues, the former chairperson in charge of Financial Oversight Committee in South Sudan's National Legislative Assembly, David Nailo Mayo, says South Sudan's economy is under siege. Mayo says the market forces in the country is controlled by few individuals who are not interested in pumping money to fuel the economy of the country.
The dollar is gaining ground because most of the economy of South Sudan is import-led. With the import-led economy, we also import, you know, the inflation. The pound keeps losing ground because all our foodstuffs, beverages, and whatever you name it, are imported from abroad. And so this import-led economy is definitely you know, we lose almost every day because we don't produce. There is no production base here in South Sudan.
Someone will tell you you have oil. Isn't that production?
Oil, you know, takes everything away from us. It takes all our jobs, the South Sudanese jobs in refining the oil is all taken away. So we only sell the crude, but with that crude, we buy food from abroad. So literally, the production I'm thinking about and I'm talking about should have been agricultural base, local extraction of other you know, natural resources like gum arabic should have been going on, other natural resources like gold, which we have, other natural resources like wood, have cement, other natural resources like utilizing the water itself. We have too much water here, but we don't use it.
Let me take you back to the issue of agriculture. You are speaking as somebody who has an oversight authority because you're a lawmaker. Why is the government of South Sudan not embarking on agriculture? I come from an agricultural land. Where I come from, if you throw a coin down, it can grow into a tree.
John, you know, we have the best arable land. We have nearly 60 million hectares of arable land. We have plenty of water. We could literally irrigate every inch of our land. But you know what? You are asking me as a lawmaker. We have always allocated resources to that effect. But no one releases the money for those projects that are supposed to be productive projects. E.g., we allocated money for putting a power plant just south of Juba here. When I was the chair of finance committee, we allocated money, but no one released that money. No feasibility studies have been done, and literally nothing is happening. So, you know, it's a wonder for all of us.
When you say no one releases the money, who is supposed to release the money?
The executive, of course.
And the executive is accountable to the lawmakers, to the parliament. Why are parliamentarians not summoning the executive who is refusing to give the money?
We have done that several times, John. And even recently, we have checked why revenues are diverted away, okay? We form committees and, you know, and the cartels are much stronger than the parliament. You know that? They have resources and they can divert the resources necessary anytime, you know? So it's not that parliament is weak. Parliament is working, but, you know, the oversight role of parliament is an inverse relation with the GDP level of the country. You know, in low-income economies, the executive is always powerful.
In this situation now where we are, the dollar is gaining grounds against the South Sudanese pounds, and it appears like if you travel along the streets in Juba, you see money changers lining themselves along the streets. Where do they get that money
from?
If there's no money in the country, there's no dollar. Where do they get the money from?
Of course. This is why I told you that the cartels are more powerful in a low-income economy like South Sudan. Parliamentary oversight role is always weaker in such countries. It's not only South Sudan.
And how can you bridge that gap between the oversight and the low economy and the people you're calling them cartels? How can you bridge that gap and arrest the situation?
In fragile states, John, you know, in fragile states, it takes a longer time to develop an economy whereby, you know, parliament has a pivotal role to play and whereby, you know, cartels are easily pushed out, and whereby the local production takes shape so that the economy improves. Because with production, you can have a larger economic base of which, you know, money is circulating in the country. Money is not exported abroad. Like now, all our dollar from oil is in the country. So this is the dilemma we are facing.
How do we address this situation? Because people in Juba are crying. People all over the country are crying. And here I am talking to a lawmaker who is speaking like he's throwing his hands up.
Definitely. When something is of great magnitude, you have to throw your hands up. But how do we get out of this? This is what we are trying to address, so that when we have a local production base, what we are really talking is a long-run attempts to really, have a local production base. Whether this comes through foreign direct investments or the government shifts its, priorities and really create agricultural development, which will boost local production and agro-industry, and of which definitely some of the imported products will now be obtained locally. But to do that, to really require an investment that can really go straight to the farmers.
That's David Nailo-Mayo, a South Sudanese economist and the former chairperson of the Economic Committee in South Sudan's Legislative Assembly. He was speaking to me this past hour from the South Sudan's capital, Juba. A new report says at least 401 human rights defenders were killed in 26 countries in 2022, based on statistics from a collective initiative of human rights organizations. Olive Moore, interim director of the Ireland-based global human rights group Frontline Defenders, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme, these are targeted killings and it's not just humanitarian aid workers.
It's people who we would not normally perhaps think of when we think of human rights defenders, and local indigenous women living very rurally who are trying to protect the local river that may be polluted by transnational companies, and lawyers who are going to court and standing up for other human rights defenders. Essentially, these are individuals who can be regular individuals like you or me who are stepping up for their communities, who are stepping up for their families, and who are challenging injustice all around the world.
Of the 401 people killed last year, were a sizable number of those human rights defenders in Africa? And if so, can you describe what countries in Africa we're talking about?
Yeah, 20 of those human rights defenders were from countries in Africa. So, I mean, the first country where we saw the highest number of killings in Africa was DRC, where, of course, there's a conflict, where we saw 8 defenders who were killed for their work. South Africa, 5 human rights defenders killed, many of them from social movements that were trying to advocate for housing rights, for better conditions for those who were living in slums. And then other countries such as Sudan, for example, also 3 human rights defenders, Kenya, different places. The vast majority of human rights defenders that are killed are from the Americas, but unfortunately it's a trend that we see all around the world in all continents where human rights defenders are targeted because of their work.
Where in the world is it the most dangerous for these human rights defenders?
Colombia. Absolutely, without a doubt, Colombia. And this is something we've seen for many years now. We have tracked 401 human rights defenders all around the world who've been killed, and of those, nearly half of those are in one country, in Colombia.
Why in Colombia?
I think Colombia is a country that has experienced conflict for many decades. We had the peace accords in the last couple of years, but certainly within rural areas and remote areas of Colombia, it's still an extremely dangerous place to be. Where the state doesn't have much of a presence, and where human rights defenders, where communities, where families, where people are caught between paramilitaries and the state.
What would you say? Are things getting better or worse overall with these defenders of human rights?
I think things are getting worse, and this is what human rights defenders are telling us, what they're seeing on the ground. It's really hard to say this empirically because, of course, we only know, for example, when we say 401 human rights defenders were killed last year, we know this is underreported. There are countries, for example, we can only verify killing two human rights defenders in Afghanistan last year, but we know there were many, many more human rights defenders killed.
Back to Africa, I saw in your report that the main types of threats that you're looking at on the continent there is detentions and arrests. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that?
So this is what we see as criminalization. So one of the most effective ways of closing down civil society space and closing down the work of human rights defenders is to target them through the courts, is to threaten them or to target them with arrest, threaten them with detention. And so what it is spurious charges being made against human rights defenders. And increasingly, one of the things we're seeing is the use of counterterrorism. And this is abuse of counterterrorism, where, for example, they will be charged with working against the state. That's one area where we certainly see quite often. Another area would be around perhaps they will be charged with fraud. And again, these are all illegal, spurious charges which are made against defenders, which do two things. First of all, it takes all of their time and resources. And of course, if these charges, which often is the case when you run through long court cases and the charges are upheld, defenders are then imprisoned. So this is across the board criminalizing defenders.
That's Olive Moore, Interim Director for the island-based global human rights group, Frontline Defenders. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what do people in Africa have to say about Trump's legal battle? Stay tuned for that story after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty in New York to 34 felony charges of falsifying business records. Tuesday evening, Trump again denied the charges and attacked the New York prosecutor's motives.
Trump surrendered at a New York City courthouse, where he denied charges of involvement in a scheme to hide accusations of sexual misconduct by falsifying business records to hide payoffs to accusers, including a former adult film actor, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg.
34 false statements made to cover up other crimes. These are felony crimes in New York State, no matter who you are.
Trump was greeted by supporters as he returned to Florida and was defiant in a televised address at his Mar-a-Lago resort, where he said the prosecutor was motivated by politics.
With a local failed district attorney charging a former president of the United States for the first time in history on a basis that every single pundit and legal analyst said, there is no case, there's no case.
But a grand jury of citizens voted to charge Trump, and one analyst says his attacks on the legal process will only backfire. Paul Schiff Berman teaches law at George Washington University. He spoke by Skype.
The case is going to be heard based on the facts and the law. And I also don't think it will help him in the main with the American people, because most Americans want the legal process to operate fully and fairly, even with regard to a former president.
People who gathered outside the New York courthouse were divided and passionate. Dion Cheney is a supporter.
I'm here to support my president, Donald Trump, the greatest president in American history, probably the best leader on planet Earth ever.
Jennifer Fisher is not a fan of Trump.
He's a con man. He has a lot of people still fooled. Most New Yorkers he doesn't fool, but I hope they'll see the light.
Trump faces the unprecedented indictment while he remains a leading contender for the Republican nomination for president. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
As you just heard, Trump pleaded not guilty yesterday in a New York state court to a 34-count indictment. He's charged with falsifying business records linked to a 2016 hush money paid to an adult film actor in the first-ever criminal case against a current or former U.S. president. The case is drawing international attention in Africa. Some public venues had televisions showing the live news of Trump's court appearance. In Nairobi, fashion stylist and writer Annette Nyanguti says she was shocked to see the former president in court, but thinks it's an important event.
Good thing for democracy, because it shows No one is above the law. I think our leaders should take it as a lesson too. We've been singing about corruption for the longest time. Corruption and politicians thinking they're above the law. So having a leader, especially from the US, arraigned in court is a lesson for us as Africans.
Etienne Okech is an engineering student at the University of Nairobi.
And I think that Trump being arrested is quite surprising, because a person of his stature and influence, it's very rare for him to be arrested. I think it's quite surprising, and that the law can actually catch up to him if he is guilty. A move like that will surprise many African nations and probably inspire them to be like the US, like push the democracy agenda, that anyone who is found guilty will be punished as per the law.
However, an entrepreneur named Loveline in Port Harcourt in Nigeria thought the indictment was a mistake.
My reaction towards the charging to court of the former president of America, Donald Trump, I was shocked. I was surprised because I didn't see it coming. My reaction is I feel it's not necessary. The man is a good man. Even if there are reasons why he should be arrested, I think it's going to be sort of political propaganda, trying to tarnish his political image. And it's obviously obnoxious. I don't like it.
I do not think that the 34 felony charges are going to stand the test of time against Donald Trump. I think we have seen it so many times in history. Billionaires always getting away with crimes in the face of the law. But also the timing is very suspicious, which makes it highly possible that it could be Jordan's administration posing these threats on Trump. But like I'm saying, I don't think they will go anywhere, and we've just saw him. He pleaded not guilty in court.
These are voices from Africa reacting to the indictment of U.S. former President Donald Trump. As Christians in Iraq prepare to mark Easter Sunday this weekend, the country's chalding Catholic Archbishop says religious minorities there deserve a secure future for their rights to be respected. He made his comments at the start of one of the holiest periods in the Christian calendar. Gaflak reports from Baghdad.
In the Christian enclave of Ankawa in Iraq's northern Kurdish capital of Erbil, the faithful are gearing up for Easter celebrations, following a period of fasting and prayer known as Lent. Over the weekend, many Iraqi Christians turned out for Palm Sunday observances by gathering in churches and streets and waving olive branches, a symbol of the peace they long seek. A Catholic government employee who provided only his first name, Sarmin, described the occasion as a time for Christians to celebrate Jesus, for children especially to recognize their heritage and have hope for the future. Many Iraqis say this is especially important following the persecution of ethnic Yazidis and other religious minorities by the so-called Islamic State group. In 2014, IS rampaged through the Yazidi heartland in northern Iraq. In many cases, they forced young women into sex slavery. Many in the Yazidi community, which numbers more than 500,000, were displaced, and an estimated 5,000 were killed. Meanwhile, the Chaldean Catholic Archbishop of Erbil, Bashar Warda, tells VOA that Iraq's rich mosaic of ethnic and religious minorities, such as the Christians, feels insecure due to a lack of political stability. He notes internal disputes between the central government in Baghdad and the Kurdish regional government in Erbil, as well as interference from Iran.
Our concern as a church is the lack of a secure future, which most of our families still feel, because the whole Middle East is unstable yet. The political process after 20 years is still very fragile in Iraq. From time to time, you have all of these political crises between Baghdad and Erbil, and that's affect the economy and social life. Gives concern that all of those political parties have not yet really mature enough to lead this nation towards a prosper future.
Archbishop Warder says the rights of all of Iraq's ethnic and religious minorities families must be enshrined in the country's constitution. He says action, not just words, must be undertaken by the government to ensure that Iraqis of all backgrounds are recognized and respected.
In a sectarian society like the one that we have, the voice of minority will be always weak. So you need a government program that comes from the voice of majority should really believe, adopt, and do something concrete. It's always a call for reconciliation, a call for national identity, a call. But you need an act, not a call, an act for that.
Before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 that toppled dictator Saddam Hussein, Iraqi Christians numbered about 1.5 million. 2 decades later, only an estimated 250,000 remain in the country, analysts say. Sectarian violence and attacks on Christian churches and families in the war's aftermath, as well as the attempted genocide by Islamic State of Iraq's religious minorities, led to large numbers of Christians fleeing Iraq. Del Gavlek for VOA News, Erbil, Iraq.
From Iraq, we move to Kenya, where 2 weeks of protest against the high cost of living and alleged electoral rigging have been paused for bipartisan dialogue. Opposition leader Raila Odinga yesterday called for parties outside the parliament to be involved in the talks, while President William Ruto favors negotiations only within the legislature. Odinga warned of fresh protest if the government does not take the opposition's demands seriously. For more on the status of the talks, my colleague Douglas Mpugo reached VOA's Nairobi correspondent Mariama Diallo for details.
Sometimes it looks like it's going well because after Ruto's speech on Sunday, you know, on Monday we saw movement. We saw some of the supporters being released, which was one of the conditions. And they talked about the reconstitution of the IEBC. There was also movement with that. So it seems like it was doing well. You know, he was trying to keep his promises. But then when you listen to the other side, you know, they go back and forth here and there because I think Mr. Odinga recently reiterated what he wants, his demand. So he still wants the high cost of living to be addressed. He's also asking the government to lower the cost of fuel and electricity. And he's saying that no committee is needed for this. It only takes the government to take the measures and implement them. The reason why he said no committees is needed for that is because I think the reform and reconstitution of the IEBC, the International Electoral and Boundaries Commission, electoral reforms, he said that that was urgent. And that's the thing that is being addressed in parliament. That's the stuff that Ruto actually proposed that bipartisan group to deal with that. He's also talked about waiving the medical bills of victims of alleged police brutality, including journalists, also to compensate the families of those who lost their lives. But for balance, at least for the journalist side, I think we've heard the journalists that were injured were actually attacked and harassed by both sides. There was the police on one side and then by protesters and mobs on the other. And actually, speaking of the people, we know that 3 people have died. And speaking of the people who died today, was the burial of William Mayenga, the Maseno University student who died on that day, the first day of the protest. So you listen to Odinga, who talks about that. But then when you listen to Ruto, who was in Rwanda recently, he also kind of he still reiterates that the kind of last August elections were free and fair. He says that he's surprised that 5 months after that, that the opposition is deciding to claim that they were told by a whistleblower, for example, that the results were possibly different. And he's wondering, nobody has told him or his government why they think that the results are different.
That was Mariama Diallo, VOA's Nairobi correspondent, speaking with my colleague Douglas Mpugwa this past hour. And that is all we had for you this Wednesday. We now leave you with Emmanuel Kembe and the song Zamankuru Juja. I'm your host, John Tanza, in Washington on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bob McLean's, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.